This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Sandra, it appears in a number of different places, commenting on the fact that in the process of the reconciliation that the Torah formulates between a man and his wife suspected of unfaithfulness, there is a procedure which involves the erasing of Hashem's name. Because a piece of Torah writing on parchment, including Hashem's name, is placed in water and the name is erased. And on that procedure, the Midrash has the following to say. Rabbi Meir have a yalif dorish bichnishte b'chol aruv shuve. Rabbi Meir used to give a drosha in shul every Erev Shabbos, every Friday night. Rabbi Meir used to give a drosha. V'haves tomon chadu isiso yalife shames kale. And there used to be one lady who always used to make a point of coming to hear Rabbi Meir's sermons. Some of the Mefoshim point out that it says that she came to hear his voice. It doesn't say she came to hear his words. And they say because she didn't understand his words. She didn't understand what he was saying. But it was such an experience to hear his voice. Rabbi Meir had such kedusha that she gained some kind of spiritual elevation merely from listening to Rabbi Meir deliver his drosha. Chad zman iyani drosho. One day, Rabbi Meir gave a slightly longer than usual drosha. Azlo bayomel levese, when she came home and wanted to come inside to her house, the ashbichol butzino mitzvi, and she found that by the time she got home, the candles were out already, and her husband wasn't in too good a mood. Omar lo baylo, her husband said to her, Han Havius, where were you? Of course, the question is, where was he? What was he doing at home? She goes to shul and he stays at home. And this was not even in the time of women's lib. Amris lay, so she said to him, Havino Shamis Kale de Drusho. I went to listen to the voice of the Darshan. Omar lakach bakach, so he took a shvu, he took an oath. My wife is not permitted back into my house until she has spat in the face of the darshan. I will not have her in until she's gone to spit in the face of the darshan. He was angry. Sofo Rabbi Meir beruach hakodesh. Rabbi Meir, his ruach hakodesh, realized what had transpired. The Ovad Grome Choshosh Aime. And he made himself suffer from a migraine. Omar, and he said, Kol Isiso de Chachma Melechush La'Aime, Teisi Tilchush. And Rabbi Meir passed around the word that if there's any lady in the neighborhood who knows how to spit in an eye, and that was apparently a cure at that time for a migraine. Maybe migraine sufferers should try it nowadays too, since nothing else seems to work. Anybody who is any woman who knows how to do that, a special type of way of spitting in the eye and healing the pain, they should come in and help me out. Amrin lo megirto. So the neighbors heard this and they said they knew what was going on. And they said, "Ha'onosech teyulun levaisei avdi gar mechlochsho v'as rakiko guayne atis legabe." You've got a perfect opportunity. Your husband wouldn't let you come into the house unless you spat in the face of Rabbi Meir. Well, you can't exactly go to Rabbi Meir and spit in his face, but he's invited you. So pretend that you know how to do this, and go and spit in his eye, and he'll be grateful to you, and your husband will be satisfied, and the oath will have been fulfilled, and you can go back home. So she goes along and she's scared to do it, and he encourages her to do it. Barokis begavo shivuzimni. V'hitavlo min barokis. And so he said to Rabbi Shmuel, he said to her, spit in my eye 7 times and it will ease my pain. Omar lo, and he then said to her after she had done so, Azmin Amri Labalech, go and tell your husband, Hadzman Amrisli, behold the Rokish shivers in you. Go and tell your husband, you told me to spit once in his face, you know what I did, I love you so much, I spit 7 times in his face. And you can go. Amri lo Talmidoi. So the Talmidim were very upset, and they came to Rabbi Meir and they said, Rebbe, Kach mevazim divrei Torah? Is that how you disgrace the words of Torah? Ilu amrislon le havinan mishalchin, umaisin le umalkin le safsalo, umarayin le leinte? Why didn't you tell us? If you told us what you knew, Beruach HaKodesh, we would have got hold of the man, and we would have brought him in, and we would have lent him over the benches, and we would have beat him up, until he would have taken his wife back, that's all. Can't have this kind of nonsense in our community. And you don't have to go through this disgrace, and Torah doesn't have to be disgraced by having a spit in your face. What kind of business is this? All because of this Meshuggah husband who takes this oath. Omar Lohim, so he answered them, Lo yehi chavod Meir gadol michvod kohen. There's no reason for the dignity of Rabbi Meir to be any greater than the dignity of Hashem. Umayim shem akudesh nichtav b'kedusho, Omar akosuv shiyimochei al amoyim, b'shvilatil shalom b'nish lishtoi. If Hashem's name, which has been inscribed with such sanctity, the Torah tells us may be erased in order to reinstate peace between husband and wife, the Chovid Meir lo yichol shchein. How much more so should the dignity of Rabbi Meir be prepared to be erased in order to reestablish peace between husband and wife? That's what Rabbi Meir says. As an aside, one of the questions that I have here is the Talmidim, okay, they ask a good question, Rabbi Meir, why didn't you just tell us and we would have beat him up? But there's a more fundamental question. One of the situations in which one is permitted to tell a lie is for sholem bayis. There are certain occasions where one is permitted to tell a white lie, and to preserve peace is one of the occasions under certain circumstances. Why didn't Rabbi Meir just say to her, go back and tell your husband that you spat in my eye? That's all. So we might say because of the oath, but we don't seem to be too worried about the oath as well, because what does it help to beat him? They also won't undo the oath. And I think that we have to see from here that telling a lie to establish peace is fine, but that wouldn't have been the reason that she would have been telling a lie. She would have been telling a lie to preserve the dignity of Rabbi Meir. There was another way to keep the peace. If she would have spat in his eye, the peace could also have been kept. The only thing is, if Rabbi Meir didn't want her to spit in her eye, then in his eye, then he would have had to tell a lie. But then she would have had to tell a lie. He would have had to instruct her to tell a lie. But why then is he instructing her to tell a lie? Not in order to establish peace, but in order to save his dignity. For that, you're not allowed to tell a lie. But still, the Talmidim say we could have got him in and we could have beaten him up until he accepted her back. We can't have a situation where husbands terrorize their wives in this way. And Rabbi Meir doesn't argue with him and say, no, we mustn't. That wouldn't be the right thing to do. He says, what I did it was preferable. And he learns it from the Ribbono Shel Olam. What does he learn from the Ribbono Shel Olam? That God is prepared to have his own name erased for the sake of Sholem Bayis. But the Talmidim's question still applies. Good, you're prepared to have your dignity erased, but why do you have to if there's an alternative? If there's no other way, okay? But why do you have to have your dignity erased? If there is an alternative, we could have called him in and we would have beaten him up. So Rebbe Yelopian explains on this medrash that Rabbi Meir learns the same principle from Hashem. Hashem also doesn't have to have his name erased. The whole process of Soto, as it's described in this week's Sedra, could take place without the erasing of Hashem's name. Why does Hashem dafke put his name in? So there seems to be some kind of preference for having one's dignity erased in the establishment or in the re-establishment of peace. Not just a question of if there's no other thing to do, then you've even got to be prepared to allow your dignity to suffer. That doesn't seem to be what it's all about. It seems to require that there is in fact a preference that the way to do it, even if there is another way, there's a still better way to do it, and that's to have your dignity erased. And Rebbe says that's meant, what is meant by Ohev Sholem. When the Novi talks about Ohev Sholem, about loving peace, that's what it means. There's a difference between respecting something, liking something, and loving something.
if one likes something, admires something, respects something, then one wants it to thrive. So for example, a person might have a beautiful, very exotic plant in his garden, and he likes it a great deal, and he wants it to thrive, he wants it to grow, he wants it to be healthy. So he waters it, and he looks after it every day. He waters it. Would he object if somebody else did the job for him, if somebody else watered it? No. As long as it's getting water regularly and it's thriving, that's fine. He likes it. But if a man is in love, and all he wants is that his beloved should be happy, and his beloved meanwhile is getting on better with somebody else that she's in love with, and we say to the first man, we say, but what are you so worried about? Do you love her? Yes, I love her. So you want that she should be happy? That's all I want, that she should be happy. You want her to have a man who's looking after her and caring for her? That's all I want. Well, she's got it. It just doesn't happen to be you. So what does it bother you so much? She's happy. Not good enough. He wants to be the one. That's the difference between loving something and liking something. If you like something, as long as it's okay, it's fine, you're satisfied. If you love something, you want to be the one who's responsible for it. It's a completely different thing. To be ohev, to love something, is a completely different concept. Unfortunately, we distort words by using them too easily. And we erase the real true meaning of the words by using them so easily. The example my father always gives is, a person says he loves ice cream. What does that mean? He loves ice cream? Does that mean he really loves ice cream? It doesn't mean he loves ice cream at all. It means he loves his tummy. And ice cream makes his tummy feel good. And the proof is that when his tummy's full, then he doesn't love ice cream. Then he doesn't care tuppence about ice cream. The ice cream can melt. He doesn't care. But we use the same word. But he says, I love ice cream. And then in the next sentence he says, I love my wife. Therefore his wife is an ice cream. That's what it means. That's the level of understanding. But really there should be two completely different words. Liking and loving are two completely different concepts. When it's oyehev sholom, when there's an ahavo, as Chazal tell us, ahavo mekalkeles es hashuro. Ahavo, love, makes one do strange things. One is willing to do things that one wouldn't otherwise do. A parent for a child. What a parent is willing to do for a child. And if you went to a parent and said, you know what, you don't worry, you don't have to look after your child, you'll find somebody else to look after your child, you don't have to do it. What does the parent feel? The parent doesn't feel satisfied and say, fine, as long as he's being looked after, I don't mind, that's fine. The parent doesn't feel that way at all. The parent wants to do it himself, because the parent loves the child. And a child for a parent, you have a situation where there's a parent that needs care, you come up to a child, you say, don't worry, I look after the parent, you don't worry, it's alright. Okay, a child doesn't want that. If the child truly loves the parent, the child wants to do it himself. That's the difference between loving and liking. Liking, you want the result. The means of getting to the result is not terribly important. Loving, the means itself is equally important. The fulfillment comes out of doing it, not only out of achieving the result. The very doing of it is the fulfillment. And of course we have to develop ahava, we have to develop love in many of the things that we do. We should develop love in most of the things that we do. That's what ahavas Hashem means. Not just liking God, not just being satisfied that everything's okay up there, it doesn't matter if I do it or somebody else does it, but that the act of serving God itself fulfills me. Because of that love, that in itself brings me fulfillment, that in itself brings me satisfaction. That's what loving means. When the means is as great, if not greater, than the end itself. And that's what Hashem teaches us in this parasha of the Sotah. That in order to establish peace between the husband and wife, there must be not only a willingness, but the method of doing it is one of erasing of the ego, one of erasing of the dignity. Because that's what love really is. And if one is ohev shalom, if one loves peace, then one doesn't try to achieve peace while preserving one's own ego too. If you love peace, then one is willing to let one's ego go, but we'll discuss that in a moment. This same medrash appears in a number of places. One of the places it appears in Vayikra and Parshas Tzav, Parshas Tes. And there the medrash goes on. There the medrash is Lo Dayo Lemeilu Yeshove Lekeinu.
Omer Rabbi Shimon ben Chalafta, said Rabbi Shimon ben Chalafta, Godol Sholem.
Sholem is so great. Shekeshe Bara HaKadosh Baruch Hu es Olamoy, also Sholem ben Ha'Elyonim L'Tachtonim. When Hashem created the world, He made peace between the upper spiritual beings and the lower material beings. So between spirituality and matter, Hashem made peace. On the first day, God made spiritual bodies, upper bodies and lower bodies. There was heaven and there was earth on the first day. Second day, He made upper bodies, skies, heavens and so on. Third day, Shlishi, He dealt with the lower areas, water and so on. Fourth day, Mino Elyonim, Yehi Ma'iris. Fourth day, it's the sun and the moon, heavenly bodies, He dealt with the upper reaches. B'chamishi, on the fifth day, Tachtonim, He's creating the bottom areas again, matter. That's the fish and the birds and so on. B'shishi bo libros Odom. On the sixth day, Hashem comes to create the last remaining object of the creation, man. Omar, and He said, Imani b'irei oisoi minho Elyonim. If I now make man an angel from spiritual beings, then the spiritual forces will dominate the world. They'll be in the majority. By one creation. If I make man out of matter, then matter will dominate spirit by one creation. May also, what did Hashem do? How did Hashem resolve this conflict? Hashem created man out of matter and out of spirit. And now we get an idea of what Sholem really is. When we talk about Sholem, what it is that we're really talking about. The Derech Hashem explains the uniqueness of the creation of man in that way. And after explaining what the spiritual creations are and what the material creations are, he then says in the fifth Perek of the first section, "V'hinei nivchan v'nivdal min ha'odom levadri," and the species of man is separated and different on its own. Liyos in that murkov mishnei minei briyon nivdalim legamri, in that man alone is created of two opposite forces, of two opposite types of material. The hainu that is haneshomo ha'elyonu v'haguf hashofer, the highest of spirits, the neshomo, and the lowest of bodies, ordinary matter, material body. Mashaloi nimtso b'shum nivro acher, something which is not found in any other creature. There is no creature that combines within it these two opposites. V'chaim tzorich shetizoyer shelo itate lachashuv sheinyan sha'ar ha'balechaim kiinyan ha'odom. And here you must not think the way that psychologists like to think, that men and animals are not terribly different from one another. Because even the soul, in quotation marks, of animals is a material thing. Min hadakim shebegashmius, it is true that it is the finest of all material things. It is one of the finest of all material things. It verges on something spiritual, but it isn't. Even the soul of an animal is not a soul at all, really. It's a life force, but it's a biological life force. It's not a spiritual life force. And anything that is biological is material. And man also has such a force. He also has that type of life force. He also has a biological life. He also has an anatomical life. Because man is a living animal. That's part of him. But what man has, quite apart from his animal body, Yesh ba'odom neshomo elyuno. A man has a highest of neshomas, shehi min brio bifnei atzmo, which is a creation all of its own, nivdeles min haguf legamri, totally separate from the body, urachoiko mimeno ad ma'ud, and very far from it. Shebo v'nikshiro boi b'gzeirosi yizbarach shemoi, which has come and has attached itself to the body as Hashem has decreed. So the uniqueness of man lies in this very conflict which the Medrash outlines, the conflict of spiritual and material which God has combined in one Bria. There is no other creature that combines the spiritual and the physical forces. And that's where all man's problems come from, And that's where all man's greatness comes from. If man were just a spiritual being, he would have greatness but no challenge. If man was just a physical being, he might have challenge but no greatness. Man is a being composed of opposite forces, pulling him at all times in different directions. And that's his situation, that is the human situation. And any attempt to understand the human condition without an appreciation of this fact, any attempt to resolve human conflict without an attempt to resolve this specific tension, is bound for failure. Because that is what underlies the tension. And so we see that the human sciences are on shaky ground. Because a human science designed to study and solve human tensions while denying the spiritual nature of man can't possibly lead to any true solutions. Techniques, yes, trainings, yes, and behaviorist mechanisms, yes. But to really understand what is making man problematic, what is making him tense, what is causing his difficulties, it isn't possible if one doesn't understand the uniqueness of man. And as we discussed in the Derech Hashem Shir last Sunday, that the attempts to study human situations by comparing them to animal situations is bound for failure also. Because as similar as man and animal is, in a certain sense, that additional dimension that man has, the neshama, makes him totally different in every area. And he can cope even with biological things in a different way to the way an animal can cope. Because he can use his neshama, he can use his soul to help him cope with physical things too. And so the way a human being copes with disease, and certainly with stress-related diseases, has nothing at all to do with the way an animal copes with them. There is no connectedness at all. But if psychologists would say that kind of thing, they would be thrown out of schools of psychology, so they have to be a little bit careful. Because it's not popular to suggest that human beings are not animals. It really is so, and it's very disturbing. So we're given here two examples of the tensions and the resolution of tensions, which the Medrash calls Sholeh. The two examples are between the spiritual and the physical, synthesized in harmony in the human being, in potential harmony in the human being, and male and female, synthesized in potential harmony in marriage. And we can see, without thinking too deeply already, the enormity of the tensions that exist in these two creations. The human being, combining spirit and matter, and the marriage, combining male and female. Opposite forces pulling in opposite directions. And how many human beings have really resolved that tension? What percentage of human beings have resolved that tension and live in harmony? Very small percentage. And what percentage of marriages have resolved that tension and live in harmony? A very small percentage. And that's really where the efforts of research should be going into. That's where the efforts of advancement and of work needs to be going into. Because if that could be resolved, if human beings could find harmony within themselves, and marriages and families could find harmonies within themselves, there's very little else we would have to worry about. If people had resolved the conflicts between the spiritual and the physical, and if families had resolved the conflicts between male and female, everything else fits into place. The economy starts fitting into place, moral systems fit into place, education fits into place, politics fits into place, all sorts of things start happening. And sometimes people question the value of supporting yeshivas, supporting Kollelim and so on. What do they do? What do they contribute to the world? The answer is, if they're learning properly and they're spreading their learning properly, what they're contributing to the world is far more helpful and far more likely to solve real situations and lead to real solutions than all the billions and billions of dollars that are being poured into the human sciences. I'm not talking about the technological sciences there. Research has to take place because we need to progress. We need to find all sorts of things, and likewise in medicine. Where we're dealing with the material world, we have to analyze the material world and understand it better. But that doesn't mean that when we're dealing with human beings, and most of the problems of the world are human problems, to try and treat human problems technologically, to try and treat human problems scientifically while ignoring the spiritual, what chance is there of any kind of success? And there is no system that understands and addresses
the tension created by the spiritual and the physical, the way the Torah does. And therefore, really, what should be happening is that billions and billions of dollars should be poured into Torah. That really, if one wanted to change the world, that would change the world. But perhaps that's being a bit idealistic. Let's look at these two beings, the marriage and the human being. There is in the human being what the psychologists call the ego. I don't know exactly what they mean by that, but I think I have an understanding. I don't know. They know exactly what they mean, because if you read different psychologists defining and describing the ego, they're all different, totally different. But there is inside the human being that which drives it. In our terminology, the ego is that which the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos refers to when it says, Hakino v'hakovid v'hataiva. Mitzin es ha'odam en ha'ilam. Ma'avirin es ha'odam en ha'ilam. Jealousy, passion, and honor. The desire for those three things, they are destructive, says the Mishnah. And that's really the ego. The need to have recognition, the need to have power, however one wants to look at Freud with his sexual impulses as dominating everything, and Jung with his power impulse, whatever it is, that's that part of the human being which needs that recognition, which needs that sense of achievement. Now that ego is threatened in the world by the limitation of resources. The ego is limitless. A person doesn't die having achieved half of his ambitions. So ambition is not something that has a limit. It's not something that you can say, when I get there, that will have been enough. My wife said to me today that she was listening to a symphony of Mozart a little while ago on the CD, and she thought to herself, had I produced such a symphony, I would have been happy to retire. That's all. Just what else do you have to produce? Such perfection. What drove that man on to produce more and more and more and more? But it isn't so. You think that if you produce one perfect thing, you would be happy to withdraw and say, look what I've done. This is it. This is my life's work. But we're never satisfied. The ego is an ongoing process. V'ein odo meis v'chatzi tavosu v'yodo. One doesn't die having fulfilled half of one's ambitions. One has to know that. Ambition is something limitless. With a limitless ambition in the hearts and passions of how many people are there in the world now? 1 million. Is that right? Or 1,000 million? How many? No. How many human beings are there in the world? Sorry? 3,000 million. 3,000 million. 3,000 million people in a little world like ours. With limitless ambitions, all of them. Where are all those ambitions going to be fulfilled? People are beginning to ask that question in South Africa now. What's really happened in South Africa now, not political turmoil, that's a halibut story, that can be solved. But what's happened all of a sudden is that we have opened the possibilities of new ambitions to 20 million new people. Where are those ambitions going to be satisfied from? Where are those expectations going to be fulfilled from? And people are getting scared. That's the fear of the conflict that arises between limitless ambitions, or the ego, whatever you want to call it, and limited resources. Where you've got a lot of people running after the same things. And over Shabbos I referred to a speech that Paul Johnson gave not long ago, on an examination of the morality of socialism versus capitalism. And one of the things he says is that socialism is one response to that, and saying, right, one second, there's only a certain amount available, everybody wants, not everybody can have, so let's share it out equally. Which means you are conceding that, in fact, man's ambitions are limitless, the world is limited, and the only way you can now handle this limitation is like after the war, you've got a ration, got to share it out carefully. And of course that breeds corruption, because now you've got limitless ambitions with even more limited opportunities. So now you get black market,
and now you get cheating, and now you get stealing, and now you get bribery. There must be, in such a system, there must be corruption on a massive extent, on a massive scale.
And he claims that's one of the reasons that the socialist system is on the process of collapsing, that they've simply realized that this isn't helping. That their resources have remained limited, and their ambitions have remained limitless, and nobody's any better off. Whereas strangely enough, if you look at the capitalist countries, where everybody's allowed to just go and get as much as they want, and hop and take and build and do what they want, no restrictions, there's somehow there's more available, everybody's got more. That's a question, it's a lovely question. Paul Johnson is an amazing contemporary mind. Because I don't know how much of an academic he is and so on, I don't know. But I know that he has a perception of emes. He has an ability to look at the situation and put his finger on the truth in the most amazing way, which of course makes him extremely unpopular. It really is so. It's quite strange how the moment a person starts saying things which are true, he loses support. He loses all popularity. But it's a question that everybody should ask. There's something wrong with the reasoning. There's something magical here. How can it be that in societies, and which countries have greater resources? Has Russia got greater mineral resources? Or is America? Has Japan got great resources? Has Japan got greater? Or Africa? Where are the greater resources? There's just no comparison. So we see that the wealth of a nation has nothing to do with its resources, or how you dish them out. And if you let people's egos develop, somehow there's plenty for everybody. It's a wonderful kasha. It's a wonderful question. Everybody should be puzzled by that question. That should be something that should shake the world, that question. Morally it should shake the world. Philosophically it should be shaking the world. Because what on earth is the answer? So the economists try and answer, but it doesn't make sense at the end of the day. Paul Johnson answers. He says because in the Western societies, in capitalist societies, wealth is created from the creative power of the human being. And the creative power of the human being is also limitless. If you allow people to create their wealth, there is no limitation at all. Funny thing to say, but that's... I wonder if Paul Johnson isn't Jewish. Where does he get such a thing from? The limitlessness of human creation, that means he acknowledges that the creative power in the human being is godly. That's the power, that's the neshama, the nishmas elikim, that's an expression of godliness, and that is not limited. If you're going to encourage people to take what others have produced, then there's a limitation. When you're dealing with physical things, there's only so much, and that can only be dished up among so many people. But if you're going to encourage people to create their own wealth, then there is no limit. And the truth is, the world should have already learned that lesson at the time of the Industrial Revolution, when all the economists had predicted that there wasn't going to be enough food for England. Very simple, they just worked out how much food a piece of ground could produce, how many people there were, how many people there were going to be in a few years' time, and there was just no way that that island could produce enough food. Came the Industrial Revolution. What was the Industrial Revolution? Creative genius. And just turned all the theories upside down, and all of a sudden there was plenty, plenty for England, for England's population then and ever since, plus a lot left over to export and to do all sorts of things with. Creative genius. There is no limit to what the human being can create. That's what it means, that Hashem made man only a little less than God. Limitless in his creative powers. If we'll only encourage those creative powers, if we'll only allow those creative powers to work, if we'll only operate with those creative powers. And now, in interpersonal relationships, the same applies. Person has an ego. He has kino, jealousies, kovod, honor, kaivo, passions. Why did Hashem create such destructive forces? And what is a person meant to do with them? So if we say to ourselves, I have jealousy, I'm ambitious, I want everything, and I want honor and recognition, and I want my passions fulfilled, and there's only so much available, there's only so much time to life, and there's only so much money, and there's only so much opportunity, and I've got to go and grab whatever I can. That's the ego functioning wild, just being allowed to function without any kind of constraint. Other religions' methods of handling that is the suppression of the ego. You mustn't have kino. Mustn't have COVID. Mustn't have Taiva. It's bad. These things are all bad. Just suppress them. If you'll suppress them, you'll find it's all fine. There's plenty. And here one has to be careful, by the way, of secular psychology. Because secular psychology views Judaism as a religion. And religion is an enemy of psychology. And understandably so in some ways. And this is one of the reasons that psychology is disturbed about the suppression of the ego. They haven't figured out what to do with the ego. They haven't got a clue how to handle it or what to do with it. But they figure that suppressing it is wrong. And they're probably right about that. And religion preaches the suppression of the ego. And Judaism is a religion, therefore it's because you're filmed that you're hung up. They won't very often be as brazen enough to say that, but they'll say it some other way. Don't you think perhaps you're overdoing this religious thing a little bit? Perhaps you should relax a little bit, perhaps you should take it easy and so on. But that's not the way the Torah addresses it. You look at that, kino, kovod, taivo. Chazal say, "Ein odom mekane b'ishto Elohim kein ruach taro v'resol." A person only feels jealous and passionate about his wife if he is very, very spiritual. There's an air of purity that comes over him. But one sees that there is a role for kino. There's a role to be jealous. You see somebody else paying inordinate attention to your wife, you're meant to get jealous. It's good. That's what you're meant to do, and it's a good thing. It's a ruach taro. There's a chiyuv to be mechabed, mechabdo yoseh megufo. One has to honor one's wife more than oneself. Taiva, one has to have passions towards one's wife, certainly, and vice versa. So one sees these very three elements, which are considered so negative and so destructive, all are considered not only appropriate, but necessary in the construction of positive family life. What are we saying? We don't want the ego suppressed. We want the ego submerged in another ego. That's really what happens. What happens when a person's in love and he does all sorts of funny things which he would never normally do? Why does he do it? Why is he willing to do that? Chazal say when Avram went to the Akedah, when he took Yitzchak to be offered, he saddled the ass himself. And Chazal said, why did he have to do it himself? He was a wealthy man, he had servants, he could have told the servants to saddle the ass. When a person's in love, he does funny things. And Avraham was in love with Ribbono Shel Olam. His dignity doesn't matter. There's no self-awareness. There's no self-consciousness. There's no attempt to preserve one's own dignity when a person finds himself willing to submerge his own dignity in the dignity of the other person. What does it mean, mechabdo yosei migufo, that a man has to honor his wife more than himself? What does that mean? So what does he do with his own dignity? What does he do with his own honor? It doesn't suffer. Because when a person's in love, he doesn't mind submerging his own honor in the honor of somebody else. He finds that the greatest dignity of all. He finds that the greatest honor of all. And so with the other elements of the ego. The kino and the taiva, if it is all directed and submerged into another ego, and one finds all of a sudden that the ego no longer becomes destructive. Those same powers, those same passions, those same ambitions can be redirected. To put it a little bit differently, if one directs those passions outwardly instead of inwardly, if one uses them for outward achievement rather than for inward achievement, they become positive, not negative. So let us even take other examples. A person has kino. Take the comrades' marathon that they ran. They're on Yom Tov, they ran it. They finish in a certain time. They didn't do so well this year, but it was Yom Tov, less Yat Dishmai. Would any of those runners, perhaps with the exception of Bruce Fordyce, be able to finish in that time if they didn't have the competition? If there was nobody else running. They just said, look, run from Durban to Pietermaritzburg, let's see how fast you can do it. Who would be able to do it in that time? Probably nobody. So what is it that's driving them to achieve it? The kino. It's plain kino. The resentment that somebody else can do what I can't do. That's all it is. But that's positive. Perhaps in running from Durban to Pietermaritzburg, it's difficult to see what the that the positivity is the positiveness in that is, but be that as it may. When a man builds up his business and he keeps his eye over his shoulder and he looks at the competition and he sees they've developed a new product and it's a little bit better than his, and he starts working. Now he's going to come out with something still better. Who benefits? The world benefits. The ilm benefits. Is that negative? That's plain unadulterated kino. That's plain jealousy. But that's jealousy directed outward rather than jealousy directed inward. That's jealousy which is motivating creativity. That's jealousy which is motivating the building of new things rather than the destruction of existing things. If the person turns over, looks at over his shoulder and he says, they're making something better. Right, let's figure out how can we blow them. What can we do to really undermine this development of theirs? We can organize an industrial strike there. We can make it so that that thing isn't going to be developed. We can get some government legislation. We have enough influence to make sure that the raw material they're using to develop this product will have import duties imposed upon it, and that will make it impossible for them to produce it. That's kino destructive. These are two completely different kinos. These are two completely different jealousies. To take jealousy and use it to spur me on to greater things is perfectly legitimate. That's how the world moves forward. To use jealousy to enable me to break others and undermine others, that's the destructive jealousy, the kino which is ma'avirin esodam min ha'ilom, which pushes a person out of the world eventually. It destroys him totally and it destroys his life. And so it is with COVID. Person wants COVID, so what does he decide? He wants COVID, he's going to write a work of literature. He wants COVID, so he's going to give a lot of charity so that he gets the honor. He wants COVID, so he's going to study a lot of Torah so that people will treat him with some degree of respect. Okay, it's legitimate. It's not the best way to learn Torah, but that's what spurs people on to achievement. There's nothing wrong in using and directing the ego outward to achieve new areas. That's what ambition is. That's what legitimate ambition is. But if a person wants COVID and he thinks to himself, why am I not getting the COVID? Because this fellow there is a little bit more famous than I am. Let's get the media onto him. We'll find something, we'll find a skeleton in his cupboard somewhere, we'll destroy him. And then I'm the next one. That's negative. That's using COVID destructively rather than constructively. And so it is with taiva as well. Taiva is also a passion which may be used in certain areas to build, to drive, to motivate, but not to destroy. When a husband and wife relate to one another using the three basic elements of the ego, kino, kovod, and taiva, using it for one another, then shalom is created. You know the famous chazal, ish and isha, both have two common consonants, an aleph and a shin, which is esh, fire. Ish, aleph, yud, shin. Isha, aleph, shin, hey. In addition to that, the word for man is aleph shin eish, but it has a yud. And isha, the word for a woman, is aleph shin, which means fire, but there's a hey. And the yud in the man and the hey in the woman together is yud kei, which produces God's name. So you've got fire and fire. When a man and a woman come together, they're opposites. Their drives are opposite, their needs are opposite, their ambitions are opposite. It makes no logical sense that they can create shalom, that they can create harmony. Yet if the yud and the hey is put in, if God's name is put in, and we're talking now about a specific element, a specific aspect of God's name, Yud Kei Vov Kei is God, the God of chesed, of kindness, of creativity, God the creator, God the giver. If each one takes that fire and uses that fire to be creative in the other one, then you've got shalom, then you've got perfection and completion, then there can be harmony between husband and wife. Harmony is not created by the obliteration of the ego. We had in today's Haftarah, Vayelech Manoach achar ishto, and Manoach went after his wife. And Chazal say, Manoach am ha'oretz hoyo. Manoach was an am ha'oretz. And an am ha'oretz is about the rudest thing the Gemara ever says about anybody. That's about as far as it goes. An am ha'oretz, it really doesn't just mean that he's an ignoramus. An am ha'oretz is the Gemara's way of saying the worst thing you can imagine the Gemara would want to say about anybody. And although the Gemara doesn't stay with the view that it's because of this pasuk, but for technical reasons, the fact is, he followed his wife. That should be wonderful. That's submerging his own ego in his wife's ego. Isn't that a wonderful thing? No, that's repressing his ego. That's obliterating his ego. That's not shalom. Shalom is not removing tensions. Shalom is resolving tensions. So my man's wife says, you know, I don't want to go to the shir tonight. He says, good, so we won't go. Fine, we'll stay at home, my darling. I want shalom. Wonderful. And he's at peace. Next Shabbos, I don't think we'll go to your shul. Let's go to another shul for a change. Of course, my darling. Let's go to another shul. Why not? Shalom. Wherever you feel comfortable, we go. She was a great woman, his wife. But that's not a marriage. Marriage is not where an ego is wiped out. A marriage is not where an ego is repressed, where an ego is erased. A marriage is where an ego is used to create, to build, to develop, to involve in the other person. And sometimes the resolution of tensions take time. And sometimes there's a great deal of conflict before those tensions are resolved. Sometimes there's a great deal of friction until the gearing takes place where things can fit together. It's not something which happens overnight. It's interesting that a lot of marriage breakups can be traced to the very early, not only years, but sometimes months and sometimes weeks of a marriage. And it's not always because of the conflicts that took place in those early days. What worries me more usually is when the early days are very peaceful. Sometimes it happens that it's a real shilach min hashamayim where it just goes, and there really isn't conflict. But not because there are no tensions, because they've just clicked and resolved tensions from day one. That happens very occasionally. Usually what happens is the tensions are there. And if the young husband and wife have not been prepared for those tensions, they sometimes get shocked by them. And then one of two things happen. One of three things. They either destroy themselves, the tension lacks the yud and the kay, it's only the h, it's fire with fire, and they eat away at one another and they destroy each other's personality. Or what happens equally often is an avoidance of the whole issues. Any issue which is causing the friction, they learn to avoid. And they develop a politeness and a formality with one another, and they think they've done wonderfully. We've resolved our differences, everything's fine, everything's wonderful. Not wonderful. That's not what shalom means. Shalom means wholeness. Shalom means perfection. Shalom means completion. And there's a lot of work before that takes place. And there's sometimes a lot of fire, there's a lot of burning, there's a lot of tension that has to be resolved. But provided that is resolved through the involvement of the ego in one another, without a repression of the ego, and without an erasing of the ego, then there's a hope that it in fact works out well.
Exactly the same applies with the human being in himself. He too is made up of two parts similar to the husband and wife parts in a marriage.
He's made up of the physical and the spiritual. And there too his physical being has its ego. It has its drives. And his spiritual being has its drives. And one has to realize that the physical does not have to be repressed in order to satisfy the spiritual. It does not have to be ignored and it does not have to be obliterated. It needs to be channeled. In just the same way as the husband and the wife need to channel their egos into one another, so the spiritual and the physical parts of the human being need to channel their egos into one another. And here just briefly, in order to round the subject off, there is a specific relationship, or a specific aspect, a specific dynamics in the male-female relationship, and a specific dynamic in the spiritual-physical relationship, which are parallel. And that is that the dynamic at any given time is from one pole to the other. We're talking about two poles, spiritual-physical, male-female. And at any specific time, the dynamic is from one to the other. The greatest fulfillment is when the dynamic is from the spiritual to the physical. When the dynamic is from the content to the container. When it is the spiritual that is affecting the physical. I don't want to get too involved in this because this is really the marriage series of Shiurim, which I haven't done for a long time, and perhaps it's time to do them again. And so any difficulties that those of you who are new to the subject might experience, just leave it until we deal with it in greater detail. Because as in the case of Paul Johnson, when something is true, it's unpopular. The same applies in an understanding of male-female relationships, where the first principle is that there is nothing equal about male and female. There is nothing similar about male and female in terms of their relationship to one another. They're different, they're opposites, they have different roles, and they fulfill one another to the greatest degree when each excels in their specific roles, not when each tries to imitate the other.
And of course there's no male who is 100% male, and there's no female who is 100% female.
So we're talking generally, when we talk about a male and a female, we're talking about in a very general sense.
But accepting that generality, the female represents the more material and the male the more spiritual.
Material not in the sense of spiritless matter, but material in the sense of the environment in which the male operates. As Chazal say, Lo ilam lo karis le ishti, ishti el obesi, I've always referred to my wife as my home. She is my home. She creates the environment. She creates the circumstance. She creates the conditions in which I live. The value system is brought into the home by the man. Who makes the value system work? The woman. The wife makes it work. The husband decides the parameters. The father decides the parameters. This is what we do. This is what we don't do. This is how far we go. That's how it is. But the one who then takes that theory and makes it practical and makes it work, that's the mother. It's a little bit like a board of directors and a managing director, a chairman and a managing director in a company. A chairman sets the policy and he draws up the parameters, and it's the managing director and his team that actually make it work on a day-to-day in a day-to-day way and put those policies and principles and theories into a working practice, into something that actually works. And so the working part, the practical side, that's the area that the woman excels in. And I've often said it's not by chance that women are not leaders in the creative sense, even today, where women have enormous opportunities, even in the areas which are traditionally feminine. They are not at the forefront of new ideas, because that's not their role, whether it's in cooking, or whether it's in dress design, or whether it's in hairdressing. All these areas which could well be traditional female areas, the innovations are not coming from women. That's not their role, to be innovators. Women are very practical, and they will take an innovative idea and they will make it practical, they will make it real, they will improve it, they will sophisticate it. But innovation is not what they are meant to do. The man is more detached from his material environment, from his physical environment. And as I've explained in the marriage shiurim, it explains, although it doesn't justify, things which cause a lot of marital tension sometimes. When a man's at his office, and he's working, and it's 5 o'clock, and it's 6 o'clock, and it's 6:30, and it's 7 o'clock, and the phone rings, and he's jolted by the phone ringing, looks at his watch, my goodness, 7 o'clock, he didn't even realize, and it's his irate wife on the other side. Where are you? I says, sorry, I'm still at the office. She says, couldn't you have phoned? I didn't have known where you are, I've been so worried. Couldn't you have phoned and told me you're still at the office? You know, I just didn't notice what the time was. What does she think? She might say kind words if she's really a tzaddikus. But what she thinks to her heart is, I don't believe it. It's not possible. It's not possible that he didn't notice the time. All that it means is that I'm not important to him. That's all. And if he's got any seichel, he'll buy some flowers on the way home. Not that it'll help a great deal, but it'll help a little bit. Because that's what she will think, because she can't imagine doing such a thing. What would any man do if his wife goes somewhere? 5 o'clock comes, 6 o'clock comes, 7 o'clock comes. And then he finds her somewhere or other. She's at the shop still. She's buying things. And he says, why didn't you tell? You said you would know you're normally back at 5. What, 7 o'clock? She said, oh, I didn't notice the time. What would he think? How happy would he feel about that? He wouldn't accept it. Because it's unlike a woman to do such a thing. A woman is very tied down to the world around her. She's in tune with her environment. Constantly in tune with her environment. She can't suddenly find herself. Again, we're talking about the theoretical woman. She can't find herself suddenly completely out of it, not aware where she is, what time it is. And that's why, one of the reasons, that men have the mitzvahs, aseh she'azman grom, or men have those mitzvahs which keep on bringing them back to time.
Shachris, Mincha, Mayriv, things that they're Shabbos, all these things that bring them back to some kind of time cycle, which a woman doesn't need. The woman, therefore, is the material. The woman is the richness of life, the matter of life. The man is the ideas. And those two have to emerge, have to merge. The man has to take his principles, he has to take his goals, he has to take his ambitions, and he has to build them into his wife so that they become part of her, and she will make them realizable. She will create an environment in which he can in fact achieve those ambitions, in which he can in fact live according to those ideals. He wouldn't be able to do it without her. He would have these wonderful ideals and this wonderful value system, but it wouldn't work. But if he's able to bring his wife to it, then she is able in turn to create an environment for him in which he can function. And that's how the partnership works. And that's why Chazal are so disparaging about poor old Manoach, Vayelech Manoach Achar Ishtoy. When it comes to value systems, when it comes to these decisions, you don't go after your wife. You teach your wife. You build your wife. You mold your wife. That's the area that the man has to work out. That's the area that he has to excel in. And she will happily follow that. If he knows where he's going, and he understands and appreciates it, she will happily follow it. And I have other news for you. Sometimes she doesn't show that she will happily follow it. She puts up a fight. You say, "That's what's a Shabbos? We have time for the shir. We've got to go to the shir." So he says, "I don't feel like the shir. There's something good on the television tonight," and all that. Now he's got to start deciding, what do we do here? So he decides to put up a little bit of a fight. He says, "Come on, what's a Shabbos? The shir. How can we miss it?" She says, "Get a tape." He says, "It's not the same. It's not nice. Not the." Eventually he thinks, you know, it's not worth having a fight about. Sholem, the last Matzah Shabbos shir was all about Sholem, and that Hashem's willing to wipe out his own name for Sholem. So surely he won't mind if I miss a Matzah Shabbos shir for Sholem. So fine, okay my darling, we won't go to the Matzah Shabbos shir. What does she feel at the end of that? Disappointment. So why was he pushing me to go in the first place? Not because it's really important, because if it was really important, he would have insisted. So he doesn't know himself what's important, what isn't. So we'll try it again next month to Shabbos. Let's see what happens then. Or it will be something else. That's not a conscious decision. That's a method that a woman uses to find what the parameters are. What does this man hold by? What is important? What isn't important to him? What's he willing to fight for and what isn't he? And it's the same, and I don't mean the comparison in any kind of disparaging way, but it's the same that one finds in the relationship between child and parent. When a child screams and says, "I don't want to go to sleep yet." And the parent says, "You don't want to go to sleep yet? Fine, stay up longer." What does the child feel? Ah, that's a parent. Am I proud of my daddy and mommy? They let me stay up as long as I want. And the little five-year-old says, "I want to run away tonight." Parents, fine, run. Put it at the door. Take a key. See you when you get back. What does the child do? Go marching out and say, "Do I have parents? 5 years old and they didn't let me go out at night." He doesn't say that at all. There's terrible disappointment, insecurity. And if the parent says to the child, "You jolly well go to sleep," and gives the child a thrust and puts him into bed, the child cries and howls. And how does the child wake up the next morning? A happy child. A happy child. You let the child go to bed whatever time he wants, how does he wake up the next morning? A terror. A worse terror than the day before. And the parent says, "I don't know what's wrong with the child, and I don't know, and it was in such a bad mood, and I can't discipline my child." What do you mean? How do you expect to discipline the child? What kind of derech eretz has your child got for you? My father said, or my mother said, "Go to bed," and I said no, so they caved in. And then later on they said, "Go to bed again, otherwise I'll smack you." And I said, "No." You think they smacked me? They didn't. They're scared of me. So what did the child feel? I've got strong parents. I've got parents who know where they're going. I've got Shlemiel's as parents. A five-year-old can terrorize them. What's going to happen if a robber breaks in tonight? I would like to see my parents. A five-year-old makes them scared. Can you imagine if somebody burgles the house, what will they be able to do? And I've got to live with these parents all my life. And the terrorist still says, "Respect them, I've still got to honor them." That's what he feels. And it's the same in a completely different sense, and obviously in an adult sense, when a husband and wife are trying to get to know one another, are trying to figure out. And she wants to know, and she will push and push and push, and get more and more, and she's entitled to. That's what builds the man's character. That's what clarifies in his own mind also, what is important and what isn't important. And the more she pushes and the more he gives in, the more she feels insecure. The more she feels she's living with a confused person who doesn't really know what he wants and where he wants. All he wants is that she should be happy. But not the loving way. Just the liking way. It doesn't matter. I'm even prepared to obliterate my own self. I'll do anything. I'll lie down and you can walk over me. That's also okay. As long as you'll be happy. That doesn't make anybody happy. That doesn't make anybody happy. And so it is in the relationship between spirit and soul. Between spirit and body. The body also pushes the spirit in exactly the same way. The ego pushes, how far can I go? And it wants to see at what point the neshama says, Adkan, this is how far you can go, no further. You want to use your honor, and you want to use your passions, and you want to use your jealousy, that's fine. But use it to build, don't use it to destroy. That's the way we live, and that's the way we operate. And that makes the body feel happy too. That makes the passions feel happy, that makes the kovod feel happy, that makes the ego thrive too. The ego doesn't lose as a result of that. The ego isn't repressed, the ego thrives. Because that way shalom is created, that way peace is created between body and soul, just as it's created between husband and wife. And so we live all the time with exciting tensions. And the world is created, as the Maseilas Yesharim says right in the very beginning, the world is created with tensions. It's out of tension that music can be created. If you want to resolve the tension in the strings of a violin, you'll have a violin without strings that have tension in them, but you won't be able to make any music. And so it is with life. It is the polarity of life that creates the opportunity for harmony. It is the opposites, it's the pulls, it's the strivings, it's the challenges that create the opportunity for the resolution of those challenges and those conflicts, and allow one to build oneself in a direction of shalom. Shalom meaning not only peace, but shalom meaning perfection, shalom in fact being one of the names of God Himself.